today. As Labour struggles with what to do next on Brexit, we ask what Jeremy Corbyn really thinks of the EU. And a year after the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, we look at what's next for the March of Our Lives movement. Do you remember being in the pouring rain up in, where were we?
Middlesbrough.
We are campaigning right up to the last minute.
These people have been waiting for like 4 hours. They loved him. One woman had a bulldog and she was like, she was going to me as if I would be able to do it. She's like, can you just get Jeremy to have a selfie with my bulldog? They loved him, didn't they?
They absolutely loved him. You know, he just wasn't able to generate that kind of buzz and enthusiasm during the referendum campaign, but because it wasn't something that he really deeply believed in.
Brexit is a bit like a nightmare scenario for Labour, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
There are some in the party desperate to stop it in its tracks. Others who say that Labour must deliver on the referendum. And as MPs prepare for another set of Brexit votes on Thursday, it feels as if this is a difficult one for Jeremy Corbyn.
How passionate are you about staying in the EU?
Oh, I'd put myself in the upper half of the 5 to 10. So we're looking at 7, 7.5.
Ooh, not quite.
Maybe 7, 7.5.
From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does Jeremy Corbyn really think about Brexit? So Jeremy Corbyn has a new pen pal. He's been exchanging letters with Theresa May over Brexit. Heather Stewart, you've been covering it all as the political editor of The Guardian. Tell me what that's all about.
So he has said throughout that he wants the opportunity to present Labour's version of Brexit.
And what is that?
Labour would like a permanent customs union, which helps with frictionless trade, helps to stop goods being stopped at the border. A close relationship with the single market, although it's based on shared institutions is the phrase, although not completely clear what that means, I think it's fair to say. And they would also like to see better protection of workers' rights and environmental standards, which at the moment are underpinned by the EU and won't be once we leave. There was also a fifth point on security relationships, which is because they're worried about how loose the forward-looking bit of Theresa May's Brexit deal is on things like sharing information about criminals and things like that.
And the letter has caused a bit of controversy among people who are anti-Brexit. Some in Labour are upset that he's reaching out to the Tories and that he apparently forgot to mention in the letter that his party still might support another referendum.
Tonight, for the first time in this referendum campaign, Labour Minister meets Labour Minister to discuss the arguments for...
It's not the first time the party has been divided over Europe.
Roy Jenkins, Home Secretary, long-term supporter of British membership and President of the Britain in Europe campaign, and Tony Benn, Secretary of State for Industry, the man who fought for this referendum and one of the leading opponents to the common market.
In 1975... there was a referendum over whether Britain should stay in the European common market, which many in Labour were opposed to because they felt it could undermine the rights of British workers.
At the time, I agreed with the argument being put forward by people like Tony Benn that you wanted a parliament that was directly accountable to voters and not to upstairs, if you like, to Brussels.
Steve Howell has been involved in Labour for decades and comes from the same political tradition as Jeremy Corbyn on the left of the party.
Across the Labour movement, in the Labour Party and in the trade unions at the time, the mainstream view was anti-common market. And certainly in Sheffield, where I was living at the time, where I was a student, the reality of it is that the fears that people had at that time have come to pass. And that's, of course, one of the factors that's contributed to the vote that we saw in 2016.
Just tell me a bit about how Corbyn's politics will have unfolded through the 70s and 80s and 90s.
Well, I think everybody in the circle that we were in remained very critical of the EU and saw it as a boss's club right up through the 70s and 80s.
A European bureaucracy totally unaccountable to anybody.
I think what changed was when Jacques Delors came to the TUC and spoke about social Europe in 1988.
It's very important for the European movement of trade union to have the support of the British.
Jacques Delors was a French socialist politician who had become president of the European Commission and wanted to persuade the British left that Europe was no longer a capitalist club.
This was the day the trade unions discovered Europe.
That did lead to a change in people's thinking. Maybe Europe could be a force for progress.
Did Jacques Delors convince you?
So there was a gradual, if you like, softening of Euroscepticism, even among people who had, like myself, been long-standing critics of the European Union. And I could see over the years, as the years went by, how European, particularly employment legislation, began to be to the advantage of workers in Britain.
So you might have softened, but I'm not sure Corbyn did. I mean, a clip emerged of him just last week from 2009 calling on the Irish to reject the Lisbon Treaty, which is in many ways the foundation of the modern European Union.
If you succeed in getting a no vote here, that will be such a boost to people like us all over Europe that do not want to live in a European empire of the 21st century.
He really didn't hold back. I mean, surely just 7 years later in 2016... Jeremy Corbyn didn't really believe in Remain.
There's a long-standing position of Remain and Reform, which I think Jeremy embraced at some point between when you're talking about 2009 and that clip and the EU referendum.
Heather, Jeremy Corbyn, to be fair to him, was quite active in the EU referendum. But did you believe him when he was arguing for Remain?
Well, so he's certainly been a Eurosceptic, but on the other hand, he is a Democrat. He's quite interested in what members of Labour think, empowering Labour members. So, you know, in the end, he was going to follow that by far the majority view in Labour, that it was better off to remain. But it was naive, I think, to expect him to be hugely enthusiastic about it or a great cheerleader for the EU project. I remember going to one speech that was trailed as, you know, Jeremy will set out how he was a Eurosceptic in the past and he's been on this journey and now he thinks the EU is wonderful.
So, Europe needs to change. But that change can only come from working with our allies in the European Union to achieve it.
You know, it wasn't a bad speech. It was quite a measured speech. But I think the phrase was something like, you know, we should stay in the EU with all its faults.
The European Union, many warts and all, has proved itself to be a crucial international framework to do that. That's why we're backing the Britain Remain in Europe campaign.
That was as enthusiastic as it got.
Thank you very much.
And was it the right decision to be that enthusiastic? Not very enthusiastic?
You know, a lot of the public felt at the time quite ambivalent about the EU. You know, their judgment was probably, you know, maybe on balance it might be better to stay in. There wasn't a great surge of enthusiasm for the EU as an institution. So I think what you could say, you know, Jeremy should have been more enthusiastic and then Remain would have won. Or you could say the subsequent result shows you that he was not way out of line with public opinion at the time.
So, Heather, you and I were co-political editors through a lot of this. And my God, I remember the night of the referendum. What a night. I think I spent the early hours of the morning in the office and then handed the baton to you to carry on. And I wandered off to Portcullis House in Parliament. And I just remember it so well. It was kind of eerily quiet. And there was this one group of Labour advisers sitting around a table. And they were all the advisers to the Shadow Cabinet who were having a meeting and they were waiting there. And honestly, they were almost in tears. I mean, it felt like this was a party that was grieving and they were furious with Jeremy Corbyn.
Mr. Corbyn, thank you very much for coming here.
Good morning.
Not least because that morning he had called for Article 50 to be triggered straight away.
Are you an enthusiastic Brexiter now?
Well, the British people have made the decision. We must respect that result, and Article 50 has to be invoked now so that we negotiate an exit from the European Union.
Was that a mistake?
Yeah, I think with hindsight it probably was, but I also think it was a very deliberate signal. He wanted to say straight away and right out of the blocks, we are not going to fight to reverse this result. You know, it was there, right there on the morning after, Labour is not going to try and overturn the result of this referendum.
It's amazing. You've got to really remember the mood at that time. The Shadow Cabinet wanted to act and they wanted to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. And ironically, it was Hilary Benn, the son of the man who had been this kind of, you know, great hero to Jeremy Corbyn, who was the person who was named as potentially wanting to start a coup.
At this critical time for our country following the EU referendum result, we need strong and effective leadership of the Labour Party. I told Jeremy Corbyn last night that I no longer had confidence in his leadership and he dismissed me from the Shadow Cabinet.
Sort of allies of Jeremy Corbyn or people close to Jeremy Corbyn have said, you know, he really, you know, is not at all fond of Hilary Benn because he sees him as having, you know, left his father's legacy behind, as it were. So it was extraordinary to see it being Hilary Benn who was a key figure in this massive resignations that you saw at that time.
So we now know Corbyn didn't just survive the coup, he won a second leadership election with a thumping victory.
Jeremy Corbyn, 61.8%.
And then, despite predictions that he was going to tank in the 2017 election, he got 40% of the vote, stripping Theresa May of her majority.
Jeremy Corbyn pulls off an astonishing result, mobilising young voters who took his brand of socialism seriously.
We're ready to serve the people.
And he was like an incredible campaigner in that election. Did you think that his enthusiasm made people more suspicious of his performance in 2016?
Yeah, I did, because it kind of reminded them that, you know, he can draw a crowd and he can rouse kind of passion. You know, I mean, some of those rallies in the 2017 general election, you know, there were people who'd taken their kids and, you know, their pets and their friends, and they were sort of waiting in the pouring rain and they were, you know, feeling great affection and kind of feeling very inspired by Jeremy Corbyn giving these speeches. And I suppose it just reminded you that those kind of rather lacklustre speeches during the referendum campaign, you know, his heart genuinely wasn't in it.
A big question now for Jeremy Corbyn is which grouping should his party be serving? The many members who now want a second referendum, the large number of Labour constituencies that voted to leave, or the party's 2017 voters? Steve, in the general election, you were a very senior advisor to Corbyn. You were at the heart of the campaign, and I know the EU wasn't a big part of your strategy, but Labour did attract a large part of the Remain vote. So even if it wasn't explicit, wasn't it really the Brexit election?
I don't think so. Certainly the evidence that we had from private polling that we were doing during the campaign showed that people were not voting in a big way on the Brexit issue. Other issues were much bigger for the majority of voters, and certainly the majority of voters we were trying to target. So I think it was mainly about austerity and about how people wanted Britain to be run, the kind of country they wanted Britain to be, not about Britain's relationship with the EU.
Heather, do you think that 2017 was about Brexit?
The debate during the election campaign wasn't nearly as much about Brexit as Theresa May hoped that it would be. She wanted it to be a Brexit election. She wanted to be sort of battling for Britain and, you know, she was going to get this tough new deal. She was going to control immigration. But actually, it became about all kinds of other issues, about austerity and cuts and other things. Those who've studied it do say, the British Electoral Study, for example, do say that Labour did pretty well at picking up Remain votes off the Conservatives, and really voters characterised Labour as the party that was likely to deliver a closer future relationship to Europe. If you were a soft Brexit person, if you felt you wanted a closer ongoing relationship, you were likely to head for Labour or to switch to Labour. So it's not true to say that Brexit was separate from the debate, I don't think.
Some think the calls for a second referendum are driven from the right of the party. They call it a Blairite coup, all about attacking the leadership. But there are many on the left of the Labour Party who want to remain in the EU too. Have you ever worn a Love Corbyn, Hate Brexit t-shirt?
I have, yes.
Alena Ivanova is part of the left-wing pressure group Momentum.
I participated in Jeremy's first leadership campaign, so I thought, wow, this is a moment where I can actually see myself joining as a party member of an official political party, and I did that. I did after Jeremy won the first leadership challenge.
Do you think the safest thing for Labour to do is to go to a more firm anti-Brexit position?
The safest thing for Labour, for me, is to have a principled position, argue from a position where it actually believes in what it's saying and what it's, you know, selling to the electorate. I'm very concerned that if we go into an election situation or anything like that, where we have either just helped the Tories deliver Brexit or we are committed to doing so, that will be incredibly demoralising to supporters and members. I mean, who is actually going to go out campaigning?
But Jeremy's principal position arguably is to be anti-Europe. Do you think Corbyn is misunderstanding what people like yourself want?
I wouldn't say that he's failing to understand us. I think he's going about it from a politician's point of view, you know. I'm just a member and I'm an activist and I know what I want and I know what I think is right and I would like my party to deliver that. The strength of my opinion kind of comes from the fact that I know that the majority of Labour members are also broadly in agreement with me. And I think for Jeremy, it's always been about giving voice to the grassroots, giving voice to the membership. As much as he's trying to win over the country, he should be trying to win over the membership as well to this position that he holds. And I don't think that that has happened. And I think ultimately he will agree that it's not about his vision, it's about the Labour Party's vision.
So Heather, there are clearly different tribes in the Labour Party when it comes to Brexit. Some on the left and right who want to stop it and others who really think the party should push ahead. How important are they to Theresa May when it comes to Thursday's votes?
The Tory whips and Theresa May's kind of close allies, her chief of staff and so on, are absolutely looking very closely at which small groups of Labour MPs they might be able to split off to balance those of their own hardliners or right wingers who, whatever she comes back with from Brussels on the backstop, will never support her.
Is there a risk now that Labour divides?
There is a risk. So there's a group of MPs, Angela Smith, Chris Leslie, Chuckerumunna, who are widely thought and have been long thought to be, to have one foot out the door, as it were, to be thinking very seriously about leaving Labour, forming some other grouping. Someone who looks very closely at this described it to me the other day as rather than a big split, for the moment, as what they called a fraying around the edges.
A fraying around the edges could be quite damaging.
Absolutely.
So look, this is a critical time for Jeremy Corbyn. He's infuriated some in his party by holding out an olive branch to Theresa May. But he's probably calculating that, politically speaking, she won't be able to go there. I mean, yesterday they clashed in the House of Commons again.
Mr. Speaker, no minister serious about protecting jobs in this country would allow a Prime Minister to deliberately run down the clock and play chicken with people's livelihoods.
What do you think Jeremy Corbyn wants in his heart of hearts?
I do think he wants it to go away as an issue, and probably the ideal scenario would be that it goes through, but it's got Theresa May's name on it. So it goes ahead. It is a Tory Brexit. You know, Jeremy Corbyn would much rather be talking about cuts to bus services than, you know, Britain's future relationship with the EU.
Heather, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Follow all the reporting of Heather Stewart and her Westminster team and keep up with the Politics Live blog at theguardian.com. Coming up, a year after the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, what's next? Now, in the year since the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, the students of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School have been steadily working to build a political movement. The Guardian's Lois Beckett has been following them.
Nearly a year ago, on Valentine's Day, 2018, there was a mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida. 17 students and teachers were killed by a former student with a military-style rifle. There have been so many mass shootings in America over the past few years, but this one was especially shocking. It had a higher death toll than Columbine. What happened after the Parkland shooting was different. The students sought out TV cameras, they went on social media, and they were furious. The students speaking out after the shooting had studied the gun control debate in their government classes. They were incredibly eloquent, and the adults who watched them were shocked at just how cogent and how furious students could be even in the aftermath of a tragedy. The survivors of the shooting immediately became more famous than the shooter himself will ever be. The Parkland students started organizing almost immediately. In the weeks after the shooting, there were multiple school walkouts across the country, but the big protest happened just about a month after the shooting, and it was centered on Washington. The March for Our Lives, as it would come to be called, ended up attracting at least 200,000 people in D.C., perhaps as many as 800,000, according to the organizers. And there were more than 800 sibling rallies across the country and the world. In all, at least a million people turned out to protest for gun control laws. Media coverage of the Parkland movement started fading right after the March for Our Lives. But the student activists were already pivoting to something different. They were trying to convert their viral social media fame into something more powerful, actual turnout in the midterm elections. They knew that just being famous advocates wasn't enough. If they wanted new gun control laws, they needed to have majorities in Congress. The Parkland students traveled all through the summer on a bus tour across the United States, all with the goal of turning out young voters to vote against politicians who refused to pass gun control laws. They focused on local media coverage, not national media coverage, and they started working very closely with local youth activists in the cities that they visited, even inviting those activists to come on tour with them. You've probably heard of David Hogg or Emma Gonzalez, the Parkland students who became the most famous in this year's activism, but the March for Our Lives has a much deeper bench than that. And what's so fascinating is that even though the movement has received much less media attention over the past couple of months, they actually delivered a pretty big victory. Youth voter turnout, the exact constituency of people that the Parkland students targeted, surged in the 2018 midterm elections. Last cycle, it was about 21% in the last midterms. This cycle, it jumped to 31%. That's the biggest increase in more than two decades. Even though the Parkland students are probably only responsible for some of that 10 percentage point increase, that's still a huge deal. It's tempting to evaluate the Parkland movement based on a single measure, whether Congress has passed any gun control laws, but I think that's a mistake. What the Parkland students are building is much more ambitious. They are trying to use gun control as a wedge issue to take and hold power for a generation. In other words, they're doing exactly what the National Rifle Association does, using gun violence as just the heart of a much broader orientation towards what it means to be a citizen, what it means to use power in a legitimate way.
That's all for today. My thanks to Steve Howell, Elena Ivanov, Heather Stewart, and Lois Beckett. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys, Elizabeth Cassin, and Maitha Lee Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.